Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Thank you for joining us today and welcome. This is an hour devoted to learning something more, not just about the world of shoes and ships and sealing wax, but about how, what, and why we think as we do. An hour for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we think we know, who we are, and who we might become. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right, our chat room is open, and my partner Ravinder awaits you there now. You can log on by going to eldontaylor.com/chat, C-H-A-T. So Ravinder, say hello to the folks and let us know what's happening in the chat room.
Well, hi, everyone. It is a wonderful day today. Actually, it's cold and snowy outside, but it's wonderful in here. And it's even more wonderful in the chat room. So do come join us. The chat room actually opens, 5-10 minutes before we go on the air. So you're always welcome to come in early, say hello, have a cup of tea, and let's get started with today's subject. So that's eldontaylor.com/chat.
All right. Now, a point of business before we continue. On April 20th and 21st, I will be presenting at the I Can Do It conference in Vancouver, Canada. I would love to meet each and every one of you there. Many of your favorite authors will be there, including Dr. Wayne Dyer, Doreen Virtue, Carolyn Miss, and Greg Braden, to name just a few. I will be speaking on self-hypnosis and subliminal technology, and this will be a hands-on, fully participatory event. So if you can, please plan to join us. You can find the details on my website and or at hayhouse.com. Okay, every week I read some of your letters as our way of respecting the very important role you play in making this show successful. Last week, our show was all about solutions to realizing our resolutions. Kim wrote, "Thank you so very much for your show on resolutions. I learned a great deal and found your generosity quite moving." Well, thank you, Kim. Everyone loves it when Mama Santa Rav is in the house. Is that right, Mama Rav?
Mama Santa Rav, I like that. That's always fun. Feels good.
Ariane wrote, "Thanks, Eldon, and thank you too, Ravinder. I love your Hay House radio show and books. They have given me great healing and helped me grow." Barbara wrote, "You are the man, Eldon. Love listening to you. My son wants to do some kind of research having to do with the brain and psychology. You have turned this generation on, literally. You have opened up our hearts and minds to all the endless possibilities that can be found in consciousness. Thank you, Eldon. I hope to meet you someday soon." Well, thank you, Barbara, and I look forward to that day as well. Bring your son with you. I am really honestly honored and thrilled to interact with young people today. And he wrote, "Yours is one of my all-time favorite Hay House shows. Thanks for all you do. Thanks to Ravinder, too." Well, I give her thanks as well. Annie, you have anything to say about that, Ravinder?
I think it's cool.
They should see that pretty smile that you get when you get these letters. I like that. Amy wrote, "I really love how you and InnerTalk have a Pay It Forward program with free downloads on your website. I love them. I try to listen to you and Rav every week on Hay House Radio. Your show is always so informative and really does provide me with some great food for thought. Love you guys. Love Provocative Enlightenment and love InnerTalk." Love your letter, Amy. Monica wrote, "I found your book, Self-Hypnosis and Subliminal Technology, so useful that I purchased a number of InnerTalk CDs as well. These CDs have had a marked and profound effect on my life. I communicate differently and much more effectively during an upset. My OCD-ness has diminished in a surprising way, and my husband, who doesn't listen to them nearly as much, has been far less abrupt and much more thoughtful, open, and communicative. This system is valid, and it definitely works." Estella wrote, "Every Tuesday I listen to your program on Hay House. It brings me so much awakening and happiness. It fills my gratitude tank. I love the way you and your lovely wife make this trip called life easier. Thank you for everything you do." Now, I like that gratitude tank. You like that one?
I do.
I do. All right, that's all the time we have for letters today, but I do invite you to opine by sending your email to eldon@eldontaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. We can't get all of your letters on the air, but they do impact our programming, and once again, I both appreciate and thank you for your feedback and continued support. Now to today's show, Science Set Free. You're going to love this show, and you should, for our guest today is Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, and in his typical no-nonsense manner, he takes science to task, using science as the tool to do so. Not unlike the great traditions of those who have seen through the scientific dogma of the past and paved the way to new paradigms, or for that matter, the insight and brilliance of Thomas Kuhn, who showed the entire scientific community the failure of science to follow its accepted methods and still break through to new discoveries not anticipated within existing paradigms. We have the splendid mind of Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. In his newest book, Science Set Free, originally titled, in fact published in the UK as The Science Delusion, Dr. Sheldrake directly exposes 10 dogmas of science that impose limits on what science finds acceptable to discover. Now, you might ask, how is that possible? I mean, I thought science was all about discovery, inquiry, the what and how of it, not the bias of some who would limit it in ways reminiscent of the old stories of how church interfered with men like Copernicus and Galileo. Certainly that doesn't go on today, does it? We'll ask our guests that question, but first, for those of you unfamiliar with Dr. Sheldrake, allow me to introduce him. Dr. Rupert Sheldrake is a biologist and author of more than 80 scientific papers and 10 books, including Science Set Free. He was educated at Cambridge and Harvard Universities and was a fellow of Clare College, Cambridge University, a research fellow of the Royal Society, principal plant physiologist at the International Crops Research Institute for the semi-arid tropics, and from 2005 to 2010, the director of the Perot-Warwick Project for Research on Unexplained Human Abilities, funded from Trinity College, Cambridge University. He is a fellow of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Rupert Sheldrake is one of the world's most innovative biologists and writers. He is best known for his theory of morphic fields and morphic resonance, which leads to a vision of a living, developing universe with its own inherent memory. I have personally been following his pioneering work for over 25 years now. He has been a guest on our show before, and everyone loved him, so let's get him back in here. Welcome back to Provocative Enlightenment, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake.
Good to be with you again.
It's our pleasure indeed. You know, the last time you were here, we discussed your book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals. We occasionally still receive email about that show, which was broadcast back in September of 2011. As much as I enjoyed that work, I think your new book is your best yet. Still, before getting started, I think there is something we should make clear. The other famous contemporary British biologist, if you will, Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, makes it quite clear that believing in a higher power is, as Freud put it, a sugar-coated neurotic crutch and has no place in the minds of mature, reasonable people. Now, in your book, UK title, The Science Delusion, you are not saying that you oppose science at all. Please make this position clear before we get into the book itself.
Yes, well, the title of the UK book, The Science Delusion, I have to say was insisted on by my British publisher, because Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, is extremely well known in Britain, mm-hmm. and they saw this as a kind of answer to Dawkins and wanted to call it that so everyone would get the point straight away. It wasn't my first choice, and I prefer the American title, Science Set Free, which actually expresses what the book's about better. But what the science delusion is, and I do believe Richard Dawkins suffers from it, is the belief that science has already figured out the nature of reality in principle, leaving any of the details to be filled in. And that, I think, is a terribly misleading view. It inhibits inquiry. It stops people looking beyond the established dogmas. And the problem really is that the 10 dogmas I discuss in my book are not really recognized by most scientists, and certainly not by militant atheists like Richard Dawkins, as dogmas. They just think they're the truth. So they're not even aware that they have these beliefs. So what I'm doing in my book really is trying to free up the sciences from this dogmatic system by making it fully conscious so that we know what the beliefs are that we're buying into unconsciously. And then open the way to a kind of scientific renaissance. So I'm not the only person doing this. There's a lot of people think this needs to happen at the moment. And I think we could see a new flowering of science when it moves beyond this narrow dogmatism. So this book is very pro-science. I mean, I'm pro-science. I've spent my whole career as a scientist. And, you know, I'm doing active research at the moment. So I'm very pro-science. But what I'm against is scientific dogmatism and the science delusion.
And I think that's wonderful that we get that point made right in the beginning, because to me, the brilliance of your work is due to your scientific training, your scientific background, and the nature of inquiry or the scientific method. So, okay, we have less than an hour to name the assumptions, the dogmas, and to flesh out the impact, and we're not likely to get through all of them. But let's begin by examining each, if we can, in a rather sequential way, beginning with Dogma 1. Everything is mechanical. Spell out some of the implications to that and how this restricts research and discards certain findings, what your own work says about this assumption, and how you might, I mean, each of these dogmas you turn into a question. So how you might rephrase this to actually question that assumption?
Well, you see, the idea that nature is mechanical or machine-like became the dominant model or paradigm of science in the 17th century. This is a very long-established view. And what it does is takes the metaphor of the machine as the only valid metaphor for understanding nature. So nature is a machine. At first they thought it was a clockwork universe. We now know that's not true. Animals and plants are machines, and we're machines. In Richard Dawkins' vivid phrase, we're lumbering robots. Our brains are nothing but computers, genetically programmed. So this idea of machines came into being because the old view in Europe, what everyone believed in Europe before modern science got going, which was taught in the medieval universities and monasteries, was that nature's alive. The medieval Christian view in Europe was that nature's like a living organism. The earth is Mother Earth. We now say Gaia, but that's not a new theory. I mean, that was what they thought. Animals and plants were truly alive in the view of the medieval philosophers like St. Thomas Aquinas. Plants had souls. The soul of the plant shaped the actual plant. It was like an invisible structuring principle around the plant, like a kind of aura, if you like. Animals had similar souls shaping their form, and then they had souls that shaped their behavior, their instincts, their senses. And that was called the animal soul. And, of course, the word animal comes from the Latin word anima, which means soul. And humans had, in addition to this plant-like soul that shapes the body, the animal soul that gives us our animal nature and instincts, the rational mind concerned with thought, language, reason, and so forth. And in the medieval view, that part of the human soul was open to God through enlightenment, through reason, and through grace. And this view of nature is what they overthrew in the scientific revolution and said, no, none of these souls exist except human reason. The only thing in nature that isn't totally mechanical, inanimate, soulless, unconscious, is the human rational mind. The human body is a machine. All of nature is a machine. Animals and plants are machines. They're unconscious. They're just mechanical. And in the 19th century, this split, this dualism between humans and the rest of nature was overcome by materialists who said, oh, we don't like having two things and making humans the same, different from everyone else. We're just machines too, and the human mind is nothing but the activity of the brain. There's no such thing as God out there. There's just mechanical nature. And so this became the materialist mechanistic view of nature, which has dominated the sciences since the 17th century in its dualistic form, and since the 19th century in its materialist form, where we too are just machines like the rest of nature made of unconscious matter.
Okay, now, obviously, I mean, you know, early animism believed that, you know, if I tripped over a log, the log intended to trip me, And so it's very easy for us to look at that and say, well, that obviously is superstitious, and dismiss it and move more towards the mechanical model. Rene Descartes, a lot of people aren't aware of this, but he was an early robotics pioneer. He actually was creating a humanoid type of robot. So I understand the gears and the whirs and why we have moved to that materialistic, mechanistic view. But your brilliance is to show us how we should be looking at it. So what's wrong with that perspective? And how would we make an inquiry that would change that assumption?
Well, I think what's wrong with this is that it's only a metaphor. It projects the human obsession with machinery onto the whole of nature. And after all, machines don't occur in nature, at least not unaided by humans. They're human inventions, and they differ from organisms in that the design of the machine and the purposes of the machine are not in the machine. They come from outside. They're designed by human engineers. They're made in human factories, and they're used for human purposes. Now, what's wrong with it is that it's only a partial metaphor. Some bits of nature are mechanical. The muscles pull the bones, and the bones are a bit like levers, and the heart's a bit like a pump, and so on. You can see mechanical metaphors have some value, but to say that it's really like that throughout in every respect is just pushing a metaphor way beyond its usefulness. And I think it's much, much more reasonable to think of living organisms as living organisms. And I mean, a dog is a living organism, not a machine. And it's a living organism with its own desires, its own purposes, its own feelings, its own mental life. And to say that it's a machine, a robot, a genetically programmed computer, is a gross distortion of metaphor and language. It's so much more sensible just to treat it as a living organism and not try to force it into an inappropriate metaphor. So I think that what this view of nature does is the mechanistic view gives us a very false view of nature and leads to false expectations, whereas the organic view enables us to see living organisms as organisms. It enables us to see the Earth as an organism, Mother Earth, Gaia, and indeed the entire universe as an organism, and galaxies as organisms. It's a kind of much more organic view. I don't think it need lead to a kind of extreme animism of the type blaming a log if you trip over it sort of thing. But I think it's not unreasonable at all to think of dogs as truly living organisms with their own mental life and feelings and emotions. I think it's very reasonable to think of all animals as having some kind of mental life. And as for plants, then I think it's very reasonable to think of them as being organized or shaped by an invisible organizing principle that's not just the chemicals inside them. So I think that this more organic view of nature gives us a much better framework for understanding the natural world.
And the kinds of experimentations or the kinds of fields of inquiry that would open up would be dramatically different than those that are available to scientists today.
Well, exactly, and many of the other dogmas in that I discuss in Science Set Free are consequences of the mechanical view. For example, dogma 5, that there's no purpose in nature, that nothing in nature has any real purpose, that animals and plants don't have any purposes of their own, and that the entire evolutionary process has no purpose. It's just a product of blind chance. This dogma, which leads to a deeply depressing view, if you take it seriously, a very depressing view of human life and of the entire cosmos as being entirely purposeless, going nowhere, just a product of blind forces and impersonal chance. This view is not something science has proved or done experiments to test or anything. It's simply an assumption. If the universe is a machine, machines have no purposes of their own, therefore there's no purpose in the universe. It's just an extension of a metaphor to lead to some kind of cosmic conclusion, which is completely inappropriate and invalid on the basis of that metaphor, which has never been tested scientifically, but which is simply assumed. So that's the problem with this dogmatic thinking. And my own view, when we come to the dogma about the laws of nature being fixed, that's one of the other 10 dogmas, that comes from a view of nature as being governed by some kind of external mathematical mind. Originally, they thought that God, in the 17th century, they thought God was a kind of engineer, a mathematical engineer, who thought the laws of nature eternally in his mind. Again, a very anthropocentric view of God. But in an organic, evolving universe, then it makes more sense to think of the regularities of nature as habits. And habits are something organisms have. We know dogs have habits, we have habits, cats have habits. I think the instincts of animals are kind of collective habits of the species. And when we see the nature as being alive, evolving, developing, and with habits, which this is part of my theory of morphic resonance, the habit principle in nature, we get a completely different view of nature from a mechanical world just proceeding in accordance with eternal mathematical laws.
You know, while you're on that subject, while we're looking at the mathematics, one of the stories that you tell has to do with the speed of light and how many times the speed of light has actually changed. And what you were told when you visited with a prominent mathematician about that or physicist about that, share that story with us, would you?
Oh, yes. Well, this is where I'm discussing the assumption or dogma that the laws and constants of nature are fixed. Now, the constants are, as the name implies, supposed to be constant, and they include the speed of light and the universal gravitational constant, the charge on the electron, and so on. There's several of these things which are called the fundamental constants. And the conventional assumption in science is that all the laws of nature and all the fundamental constants were fixed at the moment of the Big Bang, and they've never changed since then. Well, this is just an assumption. And I was looking into it to see if I turned it into a question. Have they changed? So I started looking to see what the evidence showed. When I looked at the speed of light, I looked it up, historical records over the 20th century, I found that all over the world, the speed of light dropped by 20 kilometers per second between 1928 and 1945, and then it went back up again. And in all these labs, they were measuring it as accurately as they could, and they produced values that were given to an accuracy of fractions of a kilometer. I mean, 6 or 7 decimal points. And yet, it was 20 kilometers per second different from the previous values. Then, when it went up again, the values sort of oscillated a bit around the world, and then they settled down to a new value. I didn't really understand what this could possibly mean. So I went to see the head of metrology, which is the science of measuring constants, at the National Physical Laboratory here in near London. And I said to him, I've noticed that the speed of light dropped by 20 kilometers per second between 1928 and 1945. I'd like to ask you about that. What's going on, or what was going on? And he said, oh dear, he said, you've uncovered the most embarrassing episode in the history of our science. So I said, embarrassing episode? I said, well, why is it embarrassing? He said, because there was this big change and then it went back. And I said, well, couldn't it be that the speed of light was really changing? And it did drop and then it went back up again. I mean, wouldn't that be quite exciting and interesting to know? And he said, oh, no, no. He said, it couldn't possibly have really changed. And I said, well, why not? He said, because it's a constant. So, you know, he just assumed you couldn't ask that question. And so then I said, well,
Dr. Sheldrick, I'm going to ask you to hold that right there. When we come back, we'll follow up what you said, but we've got a hard break. The computer's going to cut us off.
Okay.
We're speaking with Dr. Rupert Sheldrake about his wonderful new book, Science Set Free, 10 Paths to New Discoveries. I encourage you to get this book. If you're not already in our chat room, now is a great time to join in the conversation. We have a video for you today of our guest, and you don't want to miss what's coming up in this next half hour. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after these words from some of our friends.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. Rupert Sheldrake about his great new book, Science Set Free, 10 Paths to New Discoveries. But before we get back to the show, I want to invite you to join me on Facebook. I post regularly everything from where I am and what's on next to the latest in science, technology, and consciousness studies. And from time to time, some of my own opinions about the world we live in. I also want to remind you to be sure and register to receive my free newsletter when you visit my site and get your free MP3. Okay, let's get back to the show. Before the break, you were telling us, Dr. Sheldrake, about light speed, and that it had changed between 1928, I believe, and 1945, and that you had just been informed that it couldn't possibly have changed because it's a constant. Please pick it up and tell us that story.
Yes, well, I was saying I went to see the head of metrology at our British National Physical Laboratory, the top man in Britain on constants, physical constants, like the speed of light. And he assured me it couldn't possibly have changed because it's a constant, even though the data showed that it had changed. So I said, well, then how do you explain the fact that all over the world people were getting this figure for the speed of light 20 kilometers per second lower? And they were all agreeing with each other for more than 20 years. What was going on? And he said, it's difficult to explain. And I said, well, could it have been that they were fudging the results, so they were just getting the results they expected everyone else to get, and so it was a kind of fashion. They all adjusted their data. And he said, we don't like to use the word fudging. So I said, well, what do you prefer? And he said, we prefer to call it intellectual phase locking. So I said, if it's intellectual phase locking, how do we know that's not going on today? He said, oh, we know it's not going on today with the speed of light. And I said, why not? And he said, because we fixed it by definition in 1972. He said, that can never happen again. So I said, oh, well, you've fixed that problem. What if it really changes? And then he sat back in his chair looking very pleased with himself and with his community of metrologists. And he said, if it changes, we'll never notice because we've defined the meter in terms of the speed of light. So the units will change too. So I said, okay, so you've created a kind of closed system where we can't ever know if it changes, and it is now fixed as a constant. But what about the gravitational constant, which is still varying, and the other constants? He said, oh, well, they're more of a problem, he said. And so we went on with our discussion. But it was an extraordinary thing that here was this sophisticated man who was perfectly prepared to admit the speed of light had changed, but not prepared to admit it could really have changed. And he was then prepared to explain it in terms of a kind of collective delusion among scientists. And, of course, that does raise the question, if that could happen to such a degree with people purporting to give such accurate results which were so way off what he believed to be the truth, that kind of thing could be going on all over science if people are prepared to force their results into a mold created by dogma. Anyway, this is just one of the areas where if one looks at the data and looks at the dogma that the constants are fixed, the data don't show that. And the one that's varying most today is the universal gravitational constant, sometimes called Big G, Newton's gravitational constant, the most fundamental and indeed the oldest constant in science. That's been varying in the last few years by up to 1.3%. That may not sound very much, but these are supposed to be defined to three or four places of decimals. And this is a huge variation for something that's supposed to be defined with unbelievable precision. So in that case, they just say, well, it's just errors. It's hard to measure, so there's these errors. I myself think the gravitational constant might be changing as we move, the whole solar system moves through the galaxy. We may move through different astronomical environments, for example, which would affect the measurement. And what I'm trying to do is persuade metrologists to dig out of their files the data they've got and put them online. And then anyone who's interested could see if these so-called errors move together. For example, in one lab at any given, there was in the American National Physical Laboratory, National Bureau of Standards, they did some measurements, and they found that the gravitational constant was about more than 1% different on one day from another day a few months later. Now, what if it's high all over the world at the same time and low at other times? What if it actually fluctuates for whatever reasons? And on different labs are all observing this fluctuation, but they won't notice it because what they do is average their data, and then there's a central committee that takes the data from all the different labs and averages those to give the so-called best value of the universal gravitational constant. But it could be fluctuating, it could be changing, and they'd never notice it because they're assuming it's a constant and won't look at these variations. So that's a very practical area where the data already exist in laboratory file cabinets. And I think that it would be quite easy to see if there are correlated changes. And this is something I'm actually trying to engage metrologists in doing.
And if they were to admit that there is a fluctuation in both the speed of light and gravitational constant, we'd have a whole new story about our universe, wouldn't we?
Well, we would, and we'd be able to look at how these fluctuations happen. And it may be, I mean, I personally think that these fluctuations may be going on all the time in all the constants, within narrow limits. I don't think they're fluctuating very wildly, but... Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the time may come when we open scientific journals like Nature and Science, and each week they'd have the value, the latest value of the constants, you know, a bit like stock market reports in newspapers. You know, this week the gravitational constant was slightly up, the charge on the electron held steady, there was a drop in the fine structure constant. You know, that would mean that time has a kind of quality. There might be different things possible at different times because the constants may be fluctuating, not all in phase with each other, but they may be giving different qualities of time.
Very, very interesting. All right. I want to take on dogma two, what you call dogma two. We could spend an entire hour on this. This one is my favorite and one that I personally challenged many, many times. I love how you approach it, but essentially, dogma two, or the assumption, again, that is made, is all matter is unconscious. Now, like I say, this is a subject that we could spend more than an hour alone on, but how does this impact research and limit the findings, and how does it square with the information we currently have?
Well, of course, it doesn't square with the information we currently have. If I back up for just a minute, I think it's easier to understand why this came about. This assumption didn't come about through careful research and observations accurate to many places of decimals and experiments. It came about simply as a philosophical move. Descartes in the 17th century, as we've already discussed, thought there were two basic principles in nature, unconscious matter and conscious minds. And conscious minds were confined to human beings, angels, and God. Everything else in the universe, including the matter of human bodies, was unconscious matter. By definition, he defined it as unconscious. Then in the 19th century, the materialists came along, and they said, we don't like having two things, we just want one thing. So we'll just say there's only matter. That's what materialism is, the doctrine that there's only matter. It's the only reality. And this conscious mind just doesn't exist. So that means that God and the angels are wiped out in one stroke. And the human conscious mind then becomes nothing but the activity of the brain. It just becomes confined to the inside of the head. Now, this philosophical move by the materialists was not something carried out on the basis of experiments or research or studying animals or anything like that. It was simply an attempt to get rid of God and to make everything material and therefore subject to materialistic scientific inquiry. But the biggest thing that goes against this assumption, and the most obvious, is the fact that we're conscious ourselves. You and I ought not to be conscious if matter's unconscious and there's nothing but matter. In fact, there should be no consciousness in the universe. And the very existence of consciousness is a huge embarrassment for materialism. Incredibly enough, for the last 100 years, materialist philosophers in Britain and America have spent most of their time trying to prove that consciousness doesn't really exist, that it's either nothing but the activity of the brain, and it's just a kind of shadow of the physical activity of the brain, or that it's some kind of illusion produced by the material activity of the brain, and it doesn't do anything. But the trouble is, even that illusion theory doesn't explain it away, because illusion is a mode of consciousness. Illusions presuppose consciousness. They can't explain it away. So this is a completely contradictory, incoherent philosophy, indefensible, yet 95% of the philosophers in Britain and America for two or three generations have tried to defend it. And it's a good business for them, because they each come up with their own theory. Then the others shoot it down, because it's always implausible. And then someone comes up with a new theory, and so it goes on. But it is a most incredible thing that even in psychology in the 20th century, the mainstream in American psychology, behaviorism, started from the assumption that consciousness is an illusion and does nothing. And the only thing scientists can study are glandular secretions and muscular contractions, and i.e. measurable behavior. But the mind has no role or place to play in science, because it doesn't exist. I mean, it's unbelievable that people could actually think that. And of course, they can't really think it, because they think they themselves are conscious, and they think their own materialist philosophy is adopted on the basis of science and reason, rather than just because their brain makes them do it. So it is a completely incoherent position, and yet this is what some of the smartest people in our society and in our universities believe, and it's the dominant philosophy underlying politics, business, the educational system. It's quite unbelievable. So that is the biggest problem with materialism. Its biggest embarrassment is the fact that we're conscious and we ought not to be. We ought to be kind of zombies or computers that have no mind.
Right.
So that is the biggest problem. There are plenty of others, but that's the first and foremost one.
And once, of course, you see that, you understand clearly why there are the attacks that are made on work like, say, Clive Baxter's with a plant that responds to burning goldfish, you know, and or anything else that would attribute consciousness to something other than the human brain, where they arguably want to reduce that to some type of chemical, neurochemical reaction that's going on there. Assume that we change that, and tomorrow that was no longer assumed, no longer a dogma. What would happen? What would open up? What kind of questions would we be able to legitimately inquire? And how would you see science changing?
Well, there'd be several ways we could go. One would be to say, well, if humans are conscious, and this is part of the way we are, then what about other animals? And that's the first and easiest step. There was, in fact, a few months ago, that was called the Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness, and some of the most eminent animal behavior experts and zoologists in the world came together and produced a declaration that said they believe that animals, at least some animals, like dogs, have minds and have consciousness. Right. Well, you know, this was taken as an incredibly radical step by a very daring minority of scientists, but to almost anyone who isn't a scientist, it's blindingly obvious that dogs have minds and that cats have minds. I mean, anyone who's kept a dog or a cat or who's ridden a horse or who's lived or worked with animals knows that they're not just unconscious computers. It's a completely ridiculous theory. But it's taken science until 2012 to wake up to this fact, or at least admit it in public. Now, that, of course, means that we can think about the minds of animals instead of pretending they don't have them, and try and understand more about their inner lives. And that's something scientists have ignored till now. But I think the most interesting aspect of this is the way it opens up the question of consciousness in non-animal bodies. I mean, it may be, in fact, some philosophers like Alfred North Whitehead in the 20th century have argued that even electrons and atoms may have some kind of mental life, that consciousness may be present throughout the material realm. It's not as if there's totally unconscious matter up until the level of, say, fish or vertebrates or something, and then the light bulb of consciousness is switched on in the brain. There may be some kind of mental life right through nature, and it might apply to large things as well as small things. I mean, one of the questions that I'm very interested in is the sun conscious? The sun's a self-organizing system. It has complex electromagnetic patterns of activity within it. And if material systems, self-organizing material systems, have minds, maybe unconscious minds, maybe conscious minds, maybe both, like us, most of our mind is unconscious. Could the sun have a mind? Could it have a conscious mind? Could the sun be thinking? I think these are real questions, and I can't prove the sun's conscious, but materialistic scientists can't prove it's not. They're simply assuming that it's not and saying you're not allowed to discuss this question by creating a taboo, a dogma that can't be challenged. But there's no proof one way or the other. I think it's an open question, and I think it's a rather interesting open question to ask just how far through the universe and how big and how small are systems with minds. And once we realize we live in a living world full of beings with minds, which some may be much bigger than us, like the solar system or the galaxy, and the entire cosmos may have a mind, then we find ourselves living beings in a far greater living organism, utterly different from being isolated minds inside skulls, atomistically separated from everything else in a completely mechanical and pointless universe.
You know, I want to encourage all of our listeners, all of you out there, get this book, read it again. Once you own the information, no one who is fixed in his or her view of a mechanistic world and who touts the current scientific worldview as the know-all version, that so-called scientism that we encounter of reality, will ever again taunt you. But okay, let's go to the second or to the third dogma, Dr. Sheldrake. You know, the third dogma, the total amount of matter and energy is always the same. What's wrong with that assumption?
Well, first of all, it is an assumption. It was arrived at in the first place not by careful measurements, but simply on philosophical or actually theological grounds. In the 17th century, when science got going, modern science got going, the leading scientists of that time, like Descartes and Newton, were believing Christians, and they thought that God had created the world machine, that God was a kind of engineer. They created a new kind of theology to deal with this machine universe, and that God had created the atoms in the world, the matter they thought was made of atoms, and God had created the atoms so they could never be broken up. So the idea was the total number of atoms was always the same after God created them in the first place. Therefore, the total amount of matter was the same, couldn't become more or less. And the total amount of energy was the same because God started the universe, the world machine, in motion. And because the motion was God-given, there had to be a fixed amount of motion or force in the universe. So these were the assumptions on which the law of conservation of matter and energy were originally based. And they were formulated as we know them in the 19th century, simply codified these assumptions. But although most people take these laws very seriously, and I did myself because I thought these were inviolate truths, it turns out that physicists themselves think of themselves as rather above the law. And since the 1980s, they've produced vastly more matter and energy in the universe than anyone had known about before, in the form of dark matter and dark energy. And it's now believed that dark matter and dark energy make up 96% of the universe. The regular matter and energy that people learn about in high school is less than 4% of what's actually there, according to contemporary physics. And then you say, well, what about this dark matter and dark energy? Is the total amount of that always the same? Well, the answer is no one knows, because no one has a clue as to what dark matter and dark energy are. That's why they're called dark matter and dark energy. You can't see them. You can't detect them. There's no objective evidence for them, except for the fact they make the equations of physicists balance. Physicists' model of galaxies and of stars and galaxies, and indeed of the entire universe and the way it's expanding, simply didn't work out in their equations. Something seemed to be horribly wrong. So they just invented invisible matter and energy in exactly the right amount needed to make their equations work. So these things, these matter and energy, have been invented by physicists, vast quantities of them. They may exist, but it's a hypothesis. There's no independent evidence yet for them. But at any rate, since in the last 40 years they've invented more than 20 times as much matter and energy as anyone had previously known about, and if the theories of physics change, all this matter and energy will disappear again at the stroke of a pen. It's really hard to take seriously the idea that the total amount is absolutely fixed forever and you can't question it, since physicists themselves have manipulated the quantities so enormously just in recent decades.
You know, we've got several callers, but we have a patient one who has been on the line for a very long time, Dr. Sheldrake. And my understanding is she's a fan of yours. She just wants to say hello and thank you for being here. So I'm going to take that call in the next minute that we have before we get off the air. Barbara from Rosendale, New York, you have a message for Dr. Sheldrake.
Yes, Rupert. Hello. How are you? This is Barbara from LifeBridge Foundation.
Oh, hi, Barbara. How lovely to hear you.
You too. You too. I'm so glad you mentioned the consciousness of the sun. This was something you and I did together in 1997 in a conference. I think we should do another one. I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about the Electric Universe conference you just went to in Arizona, I think it was.
It was in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
Very quickly, please. We have less than a minute.
Well, I don't think I could cover it, Barbara, in that time, but do let me just go back to say that the consciousness of the sun was something Barbara's foundation organized, a small conference in England where about a dozen of us met and spent a few days discussing the consciousness of the sun. It was called Is the Sun Conscious? It was a really, really fun conference and a really inspiring one. And so it's great to talk to you again, Barbara, after actually quite a long time.
Yes, it's great to hear you. And I'm so glad to hear how you're describing everything, because you make it sound so clear to the layperson how ridiculous what is going on in materialistic science is these days. And hopefully your work and getting more widely known will sort of start to pierce holes in these things. That's my hope.
Well, I hope
we appreciate you calling, Barbara, and I agree with you very much. Dr. Sheldrake.
Thanks. We'll talk soon, Rupert.
Okay.
In the next 15, 20 seconds, tell our audience how they can learn more about you, your website, your book, where they can get it.
Well, the book is called Science Set Free. It's available in bookstores and through Amazon and other online sellers. And my website is www.sheldrake.org, and Sheldrake is Sheldrake, www.sheldrake.org. A great deal of information there, all free.
And a great book, and I really encourage you all to get it. Well, we've come to the end of another hour of Provocative Enlightenment, and I want to thank the wonderful team at Hay House Radio for making what we do on this show so pleasurable, and of course a big thank you to our guests and to all of you for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed our show, and we'll join us again next week, same time and same place. And if you have comments on our show, do let us know. Okay, until whenever, remember...